Hey, I'm Morgan from Seattle.
I'm Matt from Essex, Ontario.
Hey, I'm Dan from Dayton, Mass.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Lisa Kudrow has a TV series called Web Therapy, and her character is self-centered, unpleasant, kind of nasty. I feel like if I was on Friends for 10 years, that there would be a part of me that was just like, from now on, all the things I make are people's enemies.
I know. When I look at it objectively, it looks like that's what I've done, huh?
It's Bullseye. This week, Lisa Kudrow, who played the dumb one on Friends, talks about her real-life career in brain science. Eric Andre deconstructs the talk show, and I mean that completely literally. Plus, I go on a hunt for the ultimate flea market find with American picker Danielle Colby. All that and more this week on Bullseye. Every week on Bullseye, we're joined by a few of our favorite culture critics to recommend things that are worth your time. This week, we're joined by Eric Adams, assistant TV editor of the AV Club, and Claire Zolke, a contributor to the AV Club and the proprietor of Zolke.com. Hey, Eric and Claire, how are you guys doing?
Doing all right. Thanks, Jesse.
Awesome.
Now, summer is basically a television wasteland, but in an effort to guide you through it with a little bit of sustenance, Eric and Claire have picked some summer TV shows that are worth watching. Eric, I have your recommendation here. It is this television program called Gravity Falls that airs Friday nights on the Disney Channel. My concern is that we're recommending a television program on the Disney Channel, so perhaps you could allay my concerns.
Well, you know, first of all, we're in the dregs of summer, so it's just so hard to find new television to recommend to begin with. But I wouldn't hesitate to recommend the show even if we were at the start of the new fall season. This isn't the typical Disney Channel show. This is not a multi-camera sitcom starring Raven Simone or some other product of the Disney Channel machine. This is a uniquely skewed supernatural cartoon focusing on a brother and sister pair who are sent out to the wilderness of Oregon for the summer to live with their uncle, who runs a tourist trap in the small and, what they discover, mysterious town of Gravity Falls.
Is it on?
It's on. It's on. Okay. Friday night, 9:30 p.m. I, Dipper Pines.
And Mabel.
And Mabel witnessed a creature which took a bite of my sock and ran into the closet.
Are you sure it's even in there?
So, you've described the program. You have not yet allayed any fears, besides disavowing any connection to Raven Simone. What makes the show so compelling?
It's speaking from a place that hasn't been on television in a while, which is sort of this 90s sense of atmospheric spookiness that you would get from Twin Peaks or The X-Files or the short-lived kids program Eerie, Indiana. You know, supernatural stuff for kids is always very intriguing to me. I grew up during the heyday of the Goosebumps series. It's stuff that's spooky, but it doesn't get into horror movie specifics, and it's not all about the grisliness. It's about the just sort of discovering this whole new world of monsters and Bigfoots and Wolfmans and Draculas.
It also has a couple of really cool stars in Jason Ritter and Kristen Shaw.
Yes, correct. The talent involved is enough to recommend it. Linda Cardellini from Freaks and Geeks is also a voice on the show. It feels to me like a gateway to future pop culture obsession.
Claire, let's talk about the television program The Franchise. This is a reality show about baseball that follows a different baseball team each year. You claim that the second season is better than the first season. I can't imagine that being the case because the first season focused on the world's most fascinating, greatest, and overall best baseball club, the San Francisco Giants, and the second season is about the boring old Miami Marlins. Seems like a horrible mistake on the part of the producers to me.
Yeah, well, probably, but I'm probably a little bit biased. Being a Chicago White Sox fan, I'm very excited that the new season will follow the Marlins, who are managed by Ozzie Guillen. But before that, I think Showtime just maybe dropped the ball in showing how interesting the Giants can be. The first season of the franchise largely focused on the most fascinating parts of baseball, which are injury recovery and time at home with the family, which everyone loves. And there just weren't a lot of standout personalities that the show managed to pick up, aside from Brian Wilson, who was delightful and probably should have his own show. And the other issue is that a team coming off a World Series win is not that interesting because the stakes aren't very high. It's not likely that they're going to repeat. The rest of the MLB viewing audience doesn't hope they repeat, and there's just not, you know, a lot going on.
I think the problem with Showtime is that its unofficial tagline is it sort of became boring after a while.
Yeah, pretty much.
We are officially the Miami Marlins. We are a completely different team this year. All eyes are on us, for better or for worse.
So hopefully the franchise season two will become less boring than the franchise season one did.
More homeland, less the big C.
Yes, exactly.
Eric Adams recommends Gravity Falls on the Disney Channel. Claire Zolke recommends the franchise. You can catch their work online at avclub.com. And Claire also runs Zolke.com, Z-U-L-K-E-Y. Eric, Claire, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. For 10 years, my guest Lisa Kudrow played Phoebe on Friends. Phoebe was a bit dopey, but essentially sweet and might have been the show's most beloved character. Since Friends, Kudrow has balanced that sweetness with darker themes. Her Emmy-nominated lead role in The Comeback was as an actress who was more or less defined by her narcissism. In her current project, Web Therapy, she plays a therapist who conducts her sessions online. She's also kind of a terrible person. Here she is having the tables turned on her by her husband's sex therapist. In fact, her husband's straightening out therapist, played by Meryl Streep.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, of course. I'm here to help.
When's the last time you really laughed, like a real belly laugh that came from down deep inside you that you couldn't stop? When's the last time? Don't tell me. Just hold on to your answer. In the last year? In the last 5 years?
I've never been out of control, you know, where I've wet myself. No, I don't think I've ever done anything so awkward and embarrassing, no.
When's the last time that you really let yourself cry like a little girl? In the last year?
You know, I wasn't the type of little girl who cried. So I have to say that I've been a pretty emotionally consistent and stable person my whole entire life. I'm lucky that way.
I don't want you to answer me, really.
Oh.
I just want you to hold the answers in your heart.
Okay.
And find out what they tell you.
Done.
The second season of Web Therapy is now on Showtime. Lisa Kudrow, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I was excited to read that you come from a family of neurologists. I'm sure
that is exciting.
Well, it's exciting for me because I've relied on neurologists for much of my life because I get migraines.
Uh-huh.
And your father, I know, was a headache specialist.
Yeah.
You actually work with him a little bit. Did you have anybody in your family who got migraine?
I think we all did. And I know that's what made my father decide to, you know, exclusively research and treat headache.
They say that it's like they say that it's sort of a neurological oversensitivity, that it's that when that a person who gets migraines, brain wants to be in a sort of static state, and certain things that change, it freaks out over.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like that.
Well, I mean, I remember, you know, from listening to, you know, my father would, of course, lecture a lot on it. Yeah, after
just at home,
it would
or...
have no, no, not at all. You know, two other
thank
doctors.
You all for coming here.
Right, after I said, sit down and listen. No, he didn't do that. He didn't. But no, after, you know, fasting, you know, mm-hmm. if you don't eat, or, you know, after people would get them on weekends sometimes.
You grew up in Encino, California, here, not far from here.
And well, Tarzana, technically.
Tarzana.
Yeah, right next door.
and you went to college at Vassar and were not an acting student there, or you were not an acting major there.
No.
And I got the impression that maybe part of what led you into doing science in school, which is what you did, mm-hmm. Was that you wanted to do something that was, you know, I don't know, serious,
mm-hmm.
that you wanted to do something that felt like it was not a frivolous thing?
It felt important.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it felt like knowledge worth having.
Right.
You know? And, I mean, I saw my father doing it. You know, like I said, it was mostly doing research and treating patients. And it just looked really thrilling to me. And then the information, you know, when I was in high school and first took sort of a real biology class, I was hooked. I was really hooked. I thought it was the most fascinating thing.
But was it competing at the same time with a latent interest to either be funny or be an actress?
No, not at all. But not at all. Not even a little bit. No.
Really?
The answer to that is no.
I read somewhere, it was an interview related to a teen-themed movie that you did, where you described in sort of specifically a very painful adolescence.
Seventh grade was, yeah.
Specifically?
I mean, specifically. Like maybe
what happened in seventh grade?
Like the well, I had friends that dropped me. I mean, they decided they didn't want to be friends with me anymore. You know, one time I was literally attacked. I was attacked by I was in seventh grade, ninth grade guys. I was late to class and they attacked me. And I remember and one of them was popular and he watched his less popular, you know, nerdy friend attack me. And I remember telling the one friend I had left that, you know, this thing happened to me. And she went, oh, you take everything so seriously. I know that guy. He's really nice. Okay, so the world, it's upside down. I mean, it's all upside down. And nothing makes sense. And wow, that was what was so devastating, was just you have no control. And these are like wild animals. And it's not safe. This is not a safe world.
Were you good or not good at the stuff that you have to do to, you know, or did you just remove yourself nerd style?
The thing that saved me, what I did was, this is where acting comes into it, is that summer I took a play production class, which was writing sketches, and it wasn't very serious, you know, but it was just fun. And I did meet kids in there, which were in a different group. And, you know, maybe if you're looking at levels, on a higher level than the, you know, the people who dropped me even, maybe. And, you know, I became friends with them because, you know, I was funny and I did write fun sketches. And so I just, you know, worked hard at getting these new friends.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the Emmy-winning actress Lisa Kudrow, who co-starred as Phoebe on Friends. Her newest project is a web series-turned-TV show called Web Therapy. That show just began its second season and airs Monday nights at 11 on Showtime. I was so excited to read that one of the things that motivated you was the fact that your brother's best friend was John Lovitz.
Yeah.
And John Lovitz, not only I love John Lovitz. I think he's hilarious.
He's hilarious.
Just one of the funniest guys. And but I have to say that part of what delighted me was the idea that he's a real human being. because his public persona does not seem like a real person at all. And I've never seen him even at 90% of that public persona, like only 100% of him John Lovitzing around.
Right.
And so the idea that he could be a real person in real life that actually inspired someone to do something in real life was amazing to me.
No, he's a really good person. And he was so encouraging. It was so nice. And, you know, look, I had grown up with him and I'd seen him struggle. I mean, he was a theater major in college and took acting classes and would audition, and he was not giving up. And it looked like it just wasn't happening. And then he got Saturday Night Live. And I just thought, okay, so it's possible then. I mean, maybe if I just keep working at it, then it would be a possibility. I told him I wanted to be an actress, and he said, okay, great. Here's what you do. Go to the Groundlings. The most I'd ever learned was at the Groundlings, and I think improvisation is crucial.
What did you learn at the Groundlings, which you did go to?
I learned everything. I think I learned so many things.
The Groundlings is the famous Los Angeles comedy theater known for improv and character sketch.
And sketch comedy, yeah.
One of the things about doing comic improv, I mean, I guess most improv in the States is comic, but is that you have to learn to recognize almost subconsciously what is funny about what's going on and then drive that immediately, because otherwise it will be boring.
Right. I think for me, the funny was in my mind going, well, that's absurd. And then what's more absurd than that being absurd is that this person thinks it's perfectly fine or is trying to convince everyone that it's perfectly fine. That's how I approached Phoebe, you know, because it's just that's absurd. Her mother killed herself, and it's all sad. But what's absurd is that she's, you know, treating it as if, well, you know how it goes. As if everyone's had their stepfathers in prison and then you live, you know, in a car with a crack addict. You know how it goes. That's been my sort of in to comedy.
I want to play this clip from the pilot of Friends, which I just watched yesterday. And this is sort of your big scene, your big character establishment scene. And it is basically exactly along those lines.
So, that's the monologue?
Yeah. So everyone.
That was the audition piece.
Oh, wow. So everyone is sitting around the kitchen table in this scene, consoling Jennifer Aniston, who's just showed up and is super upset because she left her fiance at the altar. And then you bust out with this.
Give her a break. It's hard being on your own for the first time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I remember when I first came to this city, I was 14. My mom had just killed herself and my stepdad was back in prison. And I got here and I didn't know anybody. And I ended up living with this albino guy who was like cleaning windshields outside Port Authority. And then he killed himself. And then I found aromatherapy. So believe me, I know exactly how you feel.
The word you're looking for is... Anyway...
I mean, that is an amazing scene. It is such a terrifying string of specifics. And as I was reading, I went on Wikipedia and read the character description of Phoebe from Friends. And it basically was, you know, there's parts where they describe all her relationships with the other characters. But the intro, two or three paragraphs, the nut of this thing was just a list of nightmares. Just horrible, 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 horrible things. All one after the other. And it seems like the, you know, the juice of this character was retaining that lightness in the face of this string of horrible nightmares.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah. Very optimistic or, you know, incomplete denial. But that's a good coping mechanism sometimes.
It's funny because it strikes me as exactly the opposite of someone who at 10 has the mentality of a 30-year-old.
I kept saying, are you sure that I should play this part? I have no point of reference. I mean, I did find people, you know, that I had known that could help me along. I just mean inside my head. Like, oh, I had a friend in college who was kicked out and her parents wouldn't pay for her to go. And she had to work in a nursing home and clean up after old people and all this stuff. And she was no idiot. But she would also be very light about, oh, the other day Martha did the funniest thing. And it's this horrible, sad story about this woman with dementia who couldn't do something and she had to help. And this young girl has to clean up after all these old people. That was her job. And so I definitely drew on this girl. I thought that is just the definition of resilience to me. You know, like not – there's no state of victimhood for Phoebe or this, you know, this friend of mine. And I think that's what's really admirable. So I did have a lot of admiration for Phoebe, even if she didn't have any information, like real information, reliable information.
After a break, Lisa Kudrow on her career post-Friends. I feel like if I was on Friends for 10 years, that there would be a part of me that was just like, from now on, all the things I make are people's enemies.
I know. When I look at it objectively, it looks like that's what I've done, huh?
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Bullseye is supported in part by IFC, presenting Comedy Bang Bang every Friday at 10, 9 Central. This week, featuring guest Ed Helms with host Scott Aukerman. More information at IFC.com. And by Squarespace, a site for creating a blogger portfolio with over 100 templates and fonts using a drag-and-drop interface, offering 24-hour support and online workshops. More at squarespace.com/bullseye.
Hey guys, Nick White here. I work on the show. So it's been about 6 months since we've transitioned The Sound of Young America into Bullseye. We are really excited about the new format. We're proud of it. We're bringing you all kinds of new content. But we really do want to know what you guys think about 6 months in. So we've put together a really, really quick survey. It won't take long at all to do, but it will really help us know what you guys are thinking about the new show. So go to MaximumFun.org/bullseye survey and let us know. Please? Thanks.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actress Lisa Kudrow. She won an Emmy as Phoebe on the long-running sitcom Friends, and she starred in movies like Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion and Analyze This. She co-created and stars in the improvised comedy web series Web Therapy, which has been adapted for TV on Showtime. Was it strange to... I mean, one of the things about being on a sitcom is, especially the kind of sitcom that you were on, you know, where a multi-camera sitcom is shot in a lot of ways like a play. Mm-hmm. It's more linear than a single-camera show.
Mm-hmm.
So you basically come in once a week. You went in once a week for 10 years, 7 months out of the year or whatever, and lived in that. I have to imagine that, you know, it must affect you to be in that for so long.
Yeah, I imagine it did.
Do you have any perspective on how it did?
No, I don't. I don't think I do. I love structure. So mm-hmm. This was perfect. I mean, of course, yeah, it's perfect for any actor who'd want a steady job with a huge paycheck. Yes,
right.
Of course, duh. You know, that's my big insight. It was perfect. But what was unique is that the six of us weren't tired of it. You know, we really had fun together. One thing I learned is, you know, because I was a good student, when we would rehearse and the director say it's Jimmy Burrows is trying to get our attention to move on to the next scene or, you know, let's try it this way. And the actors are sort of like talking or playing with each other. They were playing with each other, like messing around. And it was horseplay in my head. And we're not listening to the boss. We're not listening to the dad, the boss, the teacher, you know, like you guys, we got to.
And James Burrows is the king of dads, king of comedy dads.
He is, but he...
The legendary director of every great television sitcom ever.
Well, yes. Okay, yes. That is who Jimmy Burrows is.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. Directed and executive producer of Cheers, you know, before that Taxi. But what he understood and the other actors understood that I was clueless about was, no, you have to... There has to be horseplay because you have to keep it light. This is not serious. This is not a classroom. And, you know, you're not learning surgery. And you have to keep it light and playful. You have got to be playing. And whenever I would be a guest star on a show and I would see the actors, I'm like, well, these were the people who didn't do well in school because look at them. Look at all this horseplay. No one's paying attention. We need to move along. And it took me until Friends and maybe into the second season when it finally clicked for me. No, no, they all know what they're doing. They're right. You have to keep it light and fun. And so I finally got with the program.
I was watching The Comeback this week, which was an HBO show that you did, I think, in 2004, 2005, something
right,
like
not
that.
Light.
Yeah. And
but it, good.
It's great. I hadn't seen it. And the thing that impressed me about it was, you know, the show is structured as the footage from a reality show being shot about a sitcom actress who's making a return to sitcom acting after 10 years of career doldrums.
Right.
And the thing that surprised me about it was I think I expected something, you know, a lot of shows like that are they essentially use that – they use that reality feeling to ground silliness. You know, I think The American Office is a great example. It's a brilliant program, about as good as it gets. And often what they do is they use that that aesthetic feeling of you are there in order to help you buy into something really silly happening.
Mm-hmm.
Or even, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is as good as a sitcom gets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's totally ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But because it has that feeling, you feel you buy into it 100%.
Right.
The thing about The Comeback was that it's brutal.
Right.
It is not – it's not – I mean, silly – some silly stuff happens, and there are jokes. And,
yes.
Like jokes sometimes.
Right.
But
– well, I thought it was hilarious, but also really brutal.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I was surprised that at every turn where you could have deflated – You could have deflated the emotional stakes with a jokey joke, or just something happening happy. You didn't.
Right. Because this was, 2005. It was only the second year of Amazing Race. The only, like, reality bios were Anna Nicole Smith and the Osbournes. But the, you know, I had seen The Amazing Race and I couldn't believe my eyes that there were people like vomiting and crying on TV. And I thought, well, it doesn't get more humiliating than that. And you're trading that humiliation in for what? I mean, after this show is over, you're going to do what? Like, I don't understand. I think this is dangerous. I think it's really dangerous to, you know, trade in the spotlight for your dignity. And Michael Patrick King definitely agreed. And we just felt there were so many things that we could address in that. And we thought it would make it all a little easier if this were about an actress, because at least she's signed up for that, you know. But that she's just chasing the spotlight instead of anything real and something that can carry on into the future fulfillment, you know. And she didn't need it. She had a husband who had money. She had money. You know, she didn't have to pay the rent. And so she had to throw herself into the most humiliating thing, which is a show called The Comeback. And, yeah. And just watching her chase it and swallow all this horrible stuff just so she can stay in the game and didn't care. And it was fine. She was tough. That was actually – that character was a very strong person, I thought.
Here's the thing. I mean, I think that often that kind of character, a character whose reach is bigger than what they can grab and is a little tragic, is played the way that, say, you know, Will Ferrell in Anchorman, they're played as a buffoon. And maybe there's a they usually have, if they're the main character, they're sweet in their aims, but they're a buffoon, essentially. And so you just laugh at how much they fail at things. And there are moments where you laugh at your character in that show, but that is not the main thing that's going on in that show.
I think it depends on how many times you've seen it.
Okay. In my first watch of it. Then,
yeah, brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, standing in the doorway, I don't know if I could watch another second. It's too...
It's very painful to watch you go through this.
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, the pain felt like it was... like it was grounded in something for you or your co-creator or something, and not just like it was a projection of, you know, you weren't just making fun of Anna Nicole Smith or the Osbournes or something.
Right. Well, here's what's crazy, you know, and that how much I don't know about myself. I wasn't in pain portraying her, even when the camera's super close and she looks like, I don't know what to do next, like a little panicked or that hurt. But it hurts for a split second and then, all right, well, I got to get out of this. And so then it was just spinning. Mm-hmm. Then the look was meant to show just spinning. It's okay. Got to make it okay because I'm not going to quit.
Right.
And... you know, and for Michael, too, it was just watching. I think for both of us, it was just people who won't open their eyes at all. You know, it's another form of denial. It's like, I want that and it's okay. And I can justify whatever you throw at me. I can justify why it's okay. And she's very phony and thinks that she's getting away with being funsy. But she's not. She's not getting away with it. We can see you're so phony. And... I don't know. All those things. There was a lot to it. I mean, it's hard for me to...
I mean, there's something about the fact that in order to pursue creativity professionally, you have to be able to make some assumption against repeated evidence that people want you to entertain them or want you to do whatever it is that you want to do. Despite the fact that, you know, especially for an actor, is just a string of no's. You know what I mean? And that also feels like the thing that, you know, you had to learn to develop some of that stupidity or whatever you want to call
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Foolhardiness, optimism.
Yep.
Big dreaming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's sort of the defining characteristic of this character, that she is just gonna... do whatever it is that she's going to do, despite the fact that there are all these awful pains along the way.
Right. So her, I mean, Valerie Cherish to me was, well, I'm still going to get what I want and you can try to derail me, but I'm not going to let you, you know, like I'm just that strong a person. I'm just not going to let it happen because I've got bigger plans, which aren't big plans, you know, but in her mind, they're bigger plans. And, you know, that mean writer, Polly G, he can give me the finger, he can insult me, he can do whatever he wants. But I'm not insulted if I don't feel insulted.
There's this, you know? There's a scene in the second episode where they're at the upfronts, they're presenting the sitcom, and Valerie wants to do a bit on stage, is expecting to do a bit on stage at the upfronts, which is where networks present their shows to advertisers. And so she keeps asking the writers to write a bit. And there's this scene where that mean writer comes upstairs to her room a little bit late at night, probably drunk, has this note in his hand that she wrote to him that said, can we get together a bit for the upfronts? He just comes upstairs. She opens the door, says, I'm so glad you came. He just points his finger at her like a gun, just pretends to shoot her, and then walks away. And it's overwhelming.
It's devastating. Yeah.
But it seems to me like there is something in being an actor, and maybe especially in being an actress, that is just built into it. Not to the extent that it was portrayed in the show, but that there's this kind of brutality that's built into the gig.
There definitely is. There definitely is. If you're not the star, then you don't really count. And I think actors are all treated a lot like you don't really count. You just don't really count. I mean, that's most of the time, you know, of an actor's life, which I think you were warned about, you know.
Right.
It's just going to be brutal. But I would see it in, you know, when I would be a guest star on a TV show. Like, you know, you hold your head up high when you're sort of being treated like, what are you doing here? You know, and just do it. And you don't count. You don't. You're like this invisible spot, you know, that's somehow still getting in their way somehow. And so for, you know, this writer, that's what Valerie is. I mean, I think we could have actually spent a little more time explaining what his rage against her was, that she represented reality TV and it was foisted on him by the network, who was trying to hedge their bets. Your sitcom will not be enough, and we have to have a reality show to go along with it and, you know, make the show younger, even though we're insisting that you cast this middle-aged woman, because there's that insanity of networks, too. And this guy saw himself as an artist, and he's stuck with this woman. He doesn't think she's funny. He thinks she's, you know, hacky, like a hacky sitcom actress. And, you know, she keeps coming up with these ideas that maybe worked in the late 80s. You know, got to do something fun at the upfronts, got to get their attention. And, you know, he just, she represents a lot more insult to him than I think we really showed. And also reality TV is, you know, taking work away from writers. So his whole livelihood is at stake. And, yeah, I mean, and the direction of his show is being dictated to him basically through this woman somehow. He has to use her. She doesn't fit. Yeah.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actress Lisa Kudrow. She co-created and stars in the web series turned Showtime show Web Therapy, which includes appearances from the likes of Rosie O'Donnell and Meryl Streep. Since Friends ended, I mean, at the end of Friends, you were purportedly making $1 million an episode. So mm-hmm. you just made a real, you know, like Scrooge McDuck level of money to mm-hmm. making that show. And God bless you for it. I kind of feel bad when people complain about how much a famous person makes for doing something. I'd rather they get it. They're actually involved in making the thing rather than, you know, Mr. Sony.
Mm-hmm.
that Mr. Sony.
Well, Mr. Sony's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Mick Sony?
It's Mrs. Yeah. Sony that you got to worry about. She's a real conniver.
She likes shoes.
So you had a squajillion dollars, and so you were in a position to, which is weird, that you could just do something. But on the other hand, you still have to live in an entertainment landscape mm-hmm. where you're still an actress,
mm-hmm.
where someone still has to cast you in something
right.
often, or say yes to something that you've created or co-created.
Right.
So you're in sort of a weird netherworld, because you could just stop making things
mm-hmm.
if you wanted.
Right. If money were the yeah. driving force.
Yeah.
Right.
But you still live in this world where you have to, at least to some extent, get somebody to sign off on something before you can get it.
Yeah, except for a web series.
Right. So is that how you ended up in web series? You're just like, you know what? Maybe I'm just going to make a thing that I like.
Yeah, it ultimately became that. I mean, we just had this idea that was absurd. You know, people are doing a lot of stuff on the internet, and wouldn't it be funny, because it's absurd, if they, you know, someone offered therapy, but only 3-minute sessions. And the 3 minutes was, let's see, because of like web series, a webisode, people don't like to watch things for longer than, let's say, like a 3-minute sketch. So, okay, so how do we justify that it's 3 minutes? Because the therapist will only offer 3-minute sessions. She thinks 50-minute sessions are boring. Cut to the chase. Out of the whole 50 minutes, I think 3 minutes of it were only really helpful. So let's just have those in the sessions I'm going to do. Like, none of it makes sense. It's just really – that's a horrible idea. And then it's the internet. So you don't know. I mean, anyone can just say, oh, no, I'm a specialist in this because I said it.
I want to play a conversation from the show. It's between you and Lily Tomlin, who plays your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just another really lovely illustration of your penchants for self-flagellation in your work.
Remember when you were a little child and you used to try to climb? Well, you were never little, really. You were always too pudgy. But you would try to clamber up onto my lap and cuddle. And I know I should have cuddled you, and I blame myself for not cuddling.
Well.
But it's not really your fault if you weren't appealing. And you were always eating something, you know, sticky and gooey. And I just wish that I had those days back. I would so treasure them.
Oh, well, that's a darling thought.
I just want to sweep away this dysfunctional debris that exists between us.
That's how I feel. And I think little children are sticky and gooey and unappealing.
I do think that children, even little children, realize when their mothers are rejecting them.
Do you? Well, I never felt that way. It's odd. That's never how I felt. I always
know,
felt like you were...
You're not perceptive, and you never have been.
And that's her mother. We had to explain how Fiona became Fiona.
But, I mean, I think a lot of people who were in your position would do what they could to make characters who are heroes. You know what I mean? Like, it's fun to get to be the hero. But I wonder if...
I don't think it's so fun.
Okay.
I think it's more fun to be the, you know, hilariously damaged. That person who thinks that, you know, they're pulling it off, you know, no one will be able to see how self-serving I am, even though she's not doing much to mask it.
I feel like if I was, and, you know, this may be just me, but I feel like if I was on Friends for 10 years and it was my job to be one of six people who are America's favorite people, you know, like they're just what, no matter what they did, and they did negative things, but the goal, one of the premises of that show is you want to be friends with these people,
mm-hmm.
that there would be a part of me that was just like, I just want to make, from now on, all the things I make are people's enemies.
I know. It looks like that's what I've done, huh? I know. When I look at it objectively... It looks like that's what I've done. But
does this come up in your web therapy sessions?
I don't have web therapy sessions. But no, not yet. Maybe it's an interesting thing to get to. But I think, you know, the truth is, you know, as I was in the Groundlings and creating characters, they had to push me and threaten to kick me out if I didn't finally do a ditz. It never dawned on me or occurred to me to do a dumb girl. And they had to push really hard. And then that became sort of, oh, my God, that's the easiest way, though, to get a laugh. You know, if you're auditioning for a role and it's secretary or waitress, then just make her dumb, because any line can be made funny if she's dumb. And then... next thing I know, it's almost all I was playing, which was fine. I didn't find it frustrating. I thought each dumb character I ever played, you know, was a different color of dumb. So that was really interesting to me. It was fine. But my, like, sense of humor really is, it's people who are dumb in a different way. Like, they don't see how horrible they are. They don't see how narcissistic they are, misguided or, you know, manipulative. That, to me, is what is so funny.
It's about, like, a blindness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that doesn't mean dumb, you know, like fully dumb. It's just those blind spots that everybody has about themselves. And that's what I'm amplifying, because to me that's what's really funny. I mean, we purposely had Fiona. She used to work in the world of finance. That's why she's so, there's something very self-serving and greedy about her and doesn't think about how will this impact others. What? You know, not at all. And it's just fun to explore all that, all those areas that are like different parts of our world and society and our politics and all of that. That's just really fun. And the thing is, I don't have the requirement that it needs, thank God, that it needs to be a huge hit. Like Friends was. I know enough to know that was like lightning in a bottle. You know, I think we all understood. We were there for 10 years, you know, like, well, this doesn't come along ever. So this is really lucky.
you can't expect for that to happen again. So you might as well just have a good time. Do what you want to do and see how many people show up.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you.
Lisa Kudrow's show Web Therapy is airing now on Showtime. You can also find it online at webtherapyshow.com. And if you want to watch Friends, that's on most television channels. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I did this show for years from my house, but when my son was born, things got a little too crazy to keep working from home. So instead of our staff competing for the living room with my two dogs and my little tiny baby, we got a new office. We've got it working now with desks and chairs and microphones and all that stuff, but it's almost completely barren besides that. The walls are empty. There's no character, you know. So instead of buying some prefab Swedish knickknacks, I headed to the Rose Bowl flea market to do some serious shopping. We needed something that expressed the spirit of our organization, so guests wouldn't just feel like they were doing an interview in a dentist's office. Luckily, the Rose Bowl flea market here in Southern California is one of the biggest in the country. There are 2,500 vendors in this huge parking lot outside the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, and 15,000, sometimes 20,000 people come out to shop every month. If I was going to find the perfect piece for our office, that was where I was going to find it. And to improve my odds of success, I brought in a ringer, Danielle Colby from the show American Pickers. Danielle's a bit different than your average antique dealer. She founded a roller derby team in Iowa, where she's from, and she has her own burlesque troupe, among other things.
What's your burlesque name?
Danny Diesel.
It's pretty good.
I just took it from my roller derby name.
She works at the shop from the show, but she also has her own store next door that sells clothes she designs and makes herself from vintage fabric. So, in other words, she's basically the ultimate shopping partner. When we met up, we were looking out over a field of stuff that actually, literally, went on as far as we could see. So you've never been to the Rose Bowl flea market before. Do you have any feelings about what kind of strategy we should pursue?
I think we should find the area where they have the two-headed dog taxidermy stuff, and we'll start there.
Well, let's head down to this end, and we'll just start looking.
Okay, perfect. Let's do it.
So Danielle's not a certified American picker for nothing. She pounced on the first booth that we saw. It was a booth full of cast iron animals, and it had a few Asian antiques.
Look at this door knocker. You need this for your office. You need a door knocker. Like, this is like a buck with huge antlers. Come on. Ah, and the bird cage. You need to have the bird cage.
I really don't need a bird cage.
How much is the bird cage? I'm going to take that birdcage. Can I circle around in a bit? Sorry, birdcage is mine.
You understand that we're shopping for me today,
that's
right, Danielle?
Me. Well, you know, I'm a woman. And then how much on the door knocker?
35.
35?
It's a pretty good, it's a pretty solid door knocker, but I'm a renter.
That's you still have people at your door.
But you can't put holes in your door.
The knockers were cool, but we rent our office, and I'd have to buy a replacement door when our lease ran out if I put them up. So it was already pretty hot, and I was frankly worried that this whole thing was going to be kind of an uphill battle. Still, it was early, and a few rows over, we actually spotted something pretty great.
There are these huge kind of stage chests. This one is a little bit humpbacked and is made completely of leather.
The pieces are all here. This is beautiful. I'd check on this one.
Okay, we're going to go find out how much this chest is. Can I ask you a question? How much is the chest in front, the leather one?
This one is $275. It's an early Spanish style, all leather, turn of the century. It's a beautiful piece.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's getting $275 on it.
Do it. You're not supposed to show your excitement, but I'm really excited right now. I have a hard time containing my excitement.
I just bought a chest recently. I'm thinking about this. $275 is a lot for me.
So anyway, later on that day, I saw that exact same chest at another vendor's booth. He'd bought it and marked it up a couple $100. So it was a pretty good deal. But storage is the one thing that we have in spades here at our headquarters. And anyway, I was looking for impact. And at this point, I was hot and kind of worried we'd never find it. But it's always darkest before the dawn, right?
I tell you what I really want, Danielle. I really want this Brannick foot measuring device.
You are a strange man. Why?
Because it measures your foot perfectly.
Look.
It was Danielle that found it.
Oh, you need a rocket ship.
Oh, that is a good rocket ship.
Yeah, that's awesome. Such a good rocket ship.
It works.
Holy mackerel. Okay, so you know those coin-op horses that kids ride in front of the supermarket? She found one of those, but it is a rocket, and it's yellow, and it is 6 feet tall. In other words, it is basically the single greatest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Well, how much is it?
$950.
That's you need a rocket ship.
It works?
Yeah.
So I came into this thing ready to spend some money, but it turned out that this rocket ship, awesome though it was, cost $950, which is a lot of tote bags. How'd you feel about $600? It's a public radio show, sir.
Oh, I'd say closer to $750.
Seems pretty great. How about $700?
How about $725?
How about $725 and you throw in that Brannick foot measuring device?
Oh, man. How about $750 and I'll throw that in?
Yeah. And you'll bring it to me right by MacArthur Park?
Oh. Delivery would maybe have to be a little bit extra just because I'd have to because I'd have to come all the way from Lancaster.
I'm gonna give it a look around.
Okay.
Started getting pretty intense, and I had to check in with Danielle. Danielle, what do you think? They want $850 for it. Bring it to me. Pretty great. I'll tell you, Danielle. He doesn't know this, but my logo is a rocket ship. Okay, $850. You got it.
Yeah.
Sold.
It's the deal of the day. Good job.
I'm going to have to write you a check. It's a corporate check.
The deal of the universe.
Okay.
See, I'm doing good for you.
We did it. I'm spending all my money. I'll tell you that much.
I like this. We're a good team.
Every time I think about some celebrity coming into our office for an interview and seeing that rocket ship, I get excited. I'm excited right now talking about it, and I wrote this out ahead of time. And, you know, at 10 cents a ride, that's not a liability. That's an investment. Oh, and I feel like we should mention, Danielle did give me my own burlesque name.
Space Dog. Space Dog 69. There you go.
Space Dog 69 is my new burlesque name. I'm on board. Danielle Colby is a burlesque performer with Burlesque Le Moustache. You can find them in Iowa and Southern Illinois. She's also one of the co-stars of the History Channel show American Pickers. It airs Mondays at 9. If you want to see pictures of the rocket ship we got on our trip, and how about this? I'll make a video of our producer Nick riding in it. You can visit us online at MaximumFun.org. He's shaking his head, but I'm going to make him do it. After a break, Eric Andre deconstructs the talk show. And I mean that completely literally. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and PRI. Public Radio. Contortion. Bullseye is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com. The Memory Palace is a remarkable podcast about history. To imagine it, start by wiping away whatever comes to mind when you hear podcast about history. Replace it with small, beautiful, fascinating stories. Things you'd never imagine and never expect. A sense of awe and wonder. Something amazing. That's The Memory Palace, the newest podcast in the MaximumFun.org family. Find it free in iTunes or your favorite podcatcher or online at MaximumFun.org. That's The Memory Palace, the newest podcast in the Maximum Fun family. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. The talk show has been deconstructed before on Fernwood Tonight on HBO by Martin Short's Jiminy Glick in the early years of David Letterman, but never has it been so thoroughly deconstructed as it is on The Eric Andre Show. In fact, the top of every episode of The Eric Andre Show is a montage of Andre literally deconstructing the set, destroying it with his body, also eating glass, spitting blood, just generally freaking out while a jazz combo sort of does the same thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Eric Andre Show!
Ah! Ah! Ah!
Andre, welcome to Bullpen. Hey. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this is like a defining characteristic of your television program. You flinging yourself into things and physically hurting yourself and destroying.
I'm sacrificing my body for comedy.
Everything around
laying
you.
Laying it out on the line.
Where did this part of the show come from?
I don't know. I think I don't know what like the spark of inspiration was. I was a big G.G. Allen fan in high school, and like I was into Jackass and the CKY videos that those guys made beforehand, and I was into Bad Brains and just like going to punk shows and stuff like that. So maybe from that, I don't know.
Had you ever done it on stage before you did it for the pilot of the show?
Yeah, I did the show live. The first time I did the show, my friend had a comedian friend of mine had a residency at this place in Tribeca in New York called, I think it was called The Tank. And for February, he's black, and he did like a Black History Month comedy residency for the month. And that was one of the all black performers. So he had like I got to debut the live show there in 2008. And everybody there was just kind of doing stand up and doing their thing. And then I came out and destroyed the whole stage and poured ketchup and mustard down. I had like a bikini bottom on. I poured ketchup and mustard down my pants.
Ketchup and mustard are also big characters on the television
show.
Yeah.
There's this performance artist, Paul McCarthy, who does a lot of stuff with ketchup and mustard. And there's like a lot of homages to him throughout the series. He's awesome if you can ever find any of his videos.
I mean, when you did this on stage for television, I presume you have, you know, this isn't a huge budgeted television program, but you've probably got a prop master or whatever that's called.
Yeah.
A guy who's in charge of like sawing a little notch into the table so it breaks
department.
In a particular way.
Yeah. Yeah, our art department's awesome. They're the best.
When you're on stage at a comedy theater in Tribeca, there's probably just regular stuff on the stage.
Oh, yeah. I like sliced the bottom of my foot open at the beginning of the show, and I had no idea. I had like so much adrenaline going. I had no idea till way after the show. I looked down, and like all this blood was in my shoe. And I was like, oh my God, what did I? I don't even remember doing that or when I did that. But there was no, when I was doing it in those days, there was no, it was just me. So I was just like, shopping at Kmart the day of, buying all like the ketchup and mustard and all the props and stuff. And nobody at the venue knew what I was going to. I didn't want to tell anybody at any venue what I was going to do because they would say no. So better to get in trouble and just act dumb like, oh, I didn't know. You didn't want me to break glass and flop all over the place.
I mean, what it feels like when, and you can tell me if this is actually true, what it feels like when you do that on the television show is your character on the show is so uncomfortable, so nervous, doing such a terrible job overall, that it feels like an expression of stage fright. Like it feels like something.
It is. Totally. It's all nervous energy. People ask, like, I did Jimmy Fallon and I was like jumping all over the place, and somebody tweeted like, did this guy do a mountain of cocaine before he went out on stage? And I was like, no, I'm just so nervous until I like hyperventilate my way through life. I just have kind of, it's just like life is just moments between panic attacks, so it's just coping with my nerves. That's why my stand-up's really high energy and I'm really loud and stuff like that, because I'm just terrified.
Have you always been that way?
Yeah. Always. I slept in my parents' bed till I was 10 years old. I was just nervous. I thought aliens were going to beam themselves into my closet and abduct me because I saw fire in the sky when I was like a little kid.
One of the great parts of the Eric Andre show is your interplay with Hannibal Buress, who is your sidekick.
And yeah.
You are, as we described, as nervous and active and yelly as a person on television can be, probably more than a person on television can be. Hannibal, just as he is in his day-to-day life, at least when I've interacted with him, his scale of activeness slash intensity goes from about zero to maybe 3 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's why he's the best co-host. It's like the perfect odd couple relationship. And I knew he's been part of the show since the very beginning, since I like was doodling sketches of the show, you know, on my laptop. He's always been a part of it. Years ago, for 5 years, I think I've had the idea. So I just knew he was perfect because he's just like on this. He's very creative and on the same wavelength as me creatively. He's kind of out there, and he had his own point of view and personality, but he's just like polar opposite in energy. So I thought he'd be perfect. He'd ground the whole show. I could be even crazier because he's there and he's like the voice of reality and speaking for the audience, and he's just perfect.
Let's take a listen to a bit that Hannibal does on the show. This is called the Hannibal Minute. It's sort of like an Andy Rooney type situation,
yes,
but hosted by the very funny Hannibal Buress.
I think people make too big of a deal about counterfeit money. You know how we could work with counterfeit money? Just everyone act like it's real and everything will be fine. Get that fake dough and let's just pass it around and buy sandwiches and cars.
Yep, you got to buy sandwiches inside cars. And I think that's a solution to a lot of our economic problems.
He once did a bit on our show when he was performing as a stand-up about a girl who broke up with him because her – I should be delicate about how I put this, but about how her – because her lady parts – were gentrifying. And I thought that was one of the best premises I've ever heard a stand-up comedian.
My favorite Hannibal joke, he doesn't even do it anymore. He's like, I don't sign autographs. If people ask for my autograph after the show, I don't sign autographs, but I will let you, for $10, wear my glasses for half an hour or something like that. Trying to walk around, read with them on, something like that. I'm butchering his joke. But
tell me about how the two of you started working together.
We were just doing stand-up in New York. He came out from Chicago. I was in New York, I think, for a year or two before him. We started doing stand-up and kind of started doing the festivals at the same time. I don't know. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Just running into each other constantly at shows and stuff.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Eric Andre, is the host of The Eric Andre Show on Adult Swim. Here's a bit from the show. It's in the mode of the traditional crazy newspaper headline segment of a late-night TV talk show.
Oh, cool.
But it's a little bit different as Eric shows a variety of newspaper headlines, including one that looks like it might be in Arabic.
Okay, what do we got? Killer's maps lead to victims' remains. What are we, on a scavenger hunt, folks?
It's a dark story, man. Yeah, I don't know if you should talk about it like that.
Look at this one. Pastor's daughter struck as gun accidentally goes off. Hey, guys, at least we can leave church a little early and catch the rest of the football game. Am I right, fellas?
I don't know if I like being associated with this.
Oh, what do we got here? Brita, 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 can't understand a word of it. It's my Irish proofreader, guys. Come on. Let's be a little professional. It's riffing.
We should be writing instead of riffing. That was a misstep.
You think so?
All of it.
What do you mean?
This is pretty lowbrow.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Hey, remember when I did those jokes before?
Yeah.
Tight, right?
No, I just told you that I didn't like that.
You have guests on the show. What's it like when you have, a person who is a, genuine celebrity? I was just watching Tatiana Ali on stage with you, and you are acting like a crazy person.
Yeah. Well,
do you prep them? To what extent do you prep them?
As little as possible. Like, we got to be diplomatic about it. We can't have people running back to their publicist. Throwing a hissy fit. But we want, like, genuine fear and genuine confusion coursing through people because we don't.
That's what every talk show host wants.
Yeah, we want, like, the opposite of a comfortable experience. And we want them to be genuinely uncomfortable so that they're not playing along or mugging for the camera, because then it will just turn into sketch comedy and nothing will be at risk and it won't feel dangerous. We want them to be genuine. We had this thing called the hot seat. We had this hidden heat duct that linked up to the back of Hannibal's chair, and we had carpeting over it so you couldn't see it. And when the guest would sit down, we would turn it, for certain guests, we would turn it on so that they'd be sweltering, so that they'd just be like really hot and like slowly heat was like pumping into the chair. We also had we did the meat seat, where we would put like old clams underneath the chair so that it would just start reeking. We'd have the art department like sneak, like throw old clams underneath the chair during the interview while the guest wasn't paying attention, so that it would just like stink in the studio and it would just be like unexplained. So we wanted like palpable.
Those are things that you can't necessarily, you can't see directly on television. I mean, I like that you have meat seat as a name.
Yeah.
As though it's a bit that you're doing on
the
show.
Yeah, no. We had a lot of things. We had a lot of things.
That's just a weird thing that you thought of to torture a celebrity.
Yeah, no, yeah. We were just torturing people. It was really sadistic.
Celebrities who, by the way, are generally being quite sweet about the whole thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, we thank everybody afterwards. We send them flowers, which maybe that might be even more psychological torture, but to be really nice and send people flowers afterwards. That was like the only way to get like – that was the – maybe not the only way, but the best way to get a genuine performance.
What I wonder is if you're trying to take off – I mean, Tatiana Ali is a slick lady, and you're trying to recreate in them something that you are feeling.
Yeah, totally. We told her at the beginning, I was like, you know, I play like this insane, rude inappropriate talk show host. The show kind of exists in its own universe. Don't take anything I'm saying personal if I'm being a dick or anything. I'm just playing a madman. That's the speech that we give people in the green room. And then I'm just like, and do whatever you want.
No mention of the clams under their seat.
No mention of the clams under the seat. We also don't mention to people. She told me afterwards that the thing that made her most uncomfortable, they think it's like happening in real time, like a real talk show. So they think the interview is 5 to 10 minutes max, you know, not even 8 minutes max. So, but the interview just goes on endlessly. It's like one giant 45-minute take. So that also makes the guest really uncomfortable because they're just like, they see no end in sight. It's just like this endless barrage of madness. We try to tell every guest very little because we want everything to be a surprise. You know what I mean? We have a code word for when we roll cameras on people when they don't know, when they think we're just setting up some lighting or stuff like that. And we'll use a lot of that footage because you will get people just sitting in the chair. Like, we got one guy like notices fly was down and he's like zipping it up or like kind of subtly picking their nose, stuff like that, where they don't think the camera's on. We'll use those as a, like a response. We'll like work in editing later. or we'd film rehearsals and use that as the take because people are not in their performing mode. They're like sitting in a chair looking at the sides. So why? We learned a lot of stuff from them.
When you do all of these things, why are you not a terrible person?
Oh, I am a terrible person. I'm going straight to hell after the show. But I will sacrifice my afterlife for this show.
Eric Andre is the host of The Eric Andre Show, which you can catch on Adult Swim and online at adultswim.com.
Word up. I love you.
Every week on the show, we close with a culture recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. I have to say that for a long time, I resisted salsa. I grew up in San Francisco, down the block from Caesar's Latin Palace, which was one of the biggest salsa clubs in the country. But I always associated it with, you know, white moms taking dance classes. Then the Buena Vista Social Club came out, and frankly, that didn't help. I basically just decided that it was for annoying Starbucks people, and that was that. Then a couple of years ago, I had a realization. I had gotten into boogaloo, which is a sort of Latin soul hybrid that was a precursor to salsa, and I was really enjoying it a lot. In fact, I was enjoying it so much that I just figured I should quit being such a jerk about salsa. Maybe I should actually try it. And standing in the Latin aisle of a huge record store here in L.A., I made what turned out to be a great decision. I bought the Fania All-Stars live at Yankee Stadium, Volume 2. I would have bought Volume 1, but the store was out. And then I listened to it on loop for about 3 months straight. It's a live record with a huge band, and what's amazing about it to me is that each piece of this outfit is doing something different. Nobody is playing the background, and every piece fits together perfectly until these two dozen parts are somehow a driving, throbbing whole. They're living embodiments of polyrhythm. This band, if you ask me, which you haven't, is an expression of the best of America. These guys, all different colors from countries all over the hemisphere, each bringing a little piece of where they're from to New York and creating something new and vital and just amazing. The album's basically one long highlight, but there's one song that stands out. By the time the Fania All-Stars hit Yankee Stadium in the mid-70s, Celia Cruz had been recording and performing for almost 25 years. The band was becoming legendary, but Cruz already was. Her one track on this album, recorded when she was in her mid-40s, became her signature song. It's called Bemba Colorá, and I don't think there is a more ripping pop performance on record. The lyrics are a little tough to parse. It's basically part love song, part protest song, and really is just an expression of raw force. And the song feels like a religious ritual. It builds and builds and spins and spins. It clatters and drives towards a crazy ecstasy. Somehow it's deeply grounded and completely frenzied. And then at the end of 10 minutes of this, she leaves. For a second, you're catching your breath, and then the crowd starts pumping, and the band keeps pumping, and you need her back on stage. Comes back, and she sings for a couple minutes more, which, when you're listening, that is all you want. She gets an encore for a single song in the middle of a two-hour concert. When it happens, it makes perfect sense. One of the great blessings of music is that it can take you out of yourself. It can carry you outside the walls you've built in your mind and let you revel for a moment in a breadth of feeling that you'd never reach without that beat. And I'm glad I let the Fania All-Stars pick me up and carry me there. That's my outshot. That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Our editor, Nick White. Our intern, Lindsay Pavlis. You should like us on Facebook at facebook.com/BullseyeWithJesseThorne. All of those words in one long string to get special updates. You can also find us on Twitter at Bullseye. And you can find me on Twitter at Jesse Thorne. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Bullseye is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.